Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dry Dock, episode 380. This week, the questions are taken from the guide on USS Wyoming from 1911. That's guide 447. The Wednesday video on USS Enterprise CV6 and her fight at Midway. And the Friday video on the Navy Record Society. Almirante Brown asks, I noticed in the 1913 Naval Annual that the Coventry Ordnance Works offered a 50 caliber 11.2-inch gun for sale. That struck me as an unusual caliber for a British manufacturer. Do you know the backstory to that gun? Did Coventry design it as part of a bid for a foreign warship contract? And if so, do you know about the proposed warship that was intended to carry it? Well, fortunately, the German 11-inch 50 is actually tabulated under the Krupp section in the same book. So if we look at the two by comparison, so we have the Coventry Ordnance Works 11.2-inch 50 cal, or 11.02-inch, depending on which of the two subheadings you actually believe, it gives the Coventry one, or we'll call it the British one for the minute, with a 270-pound charge firing a 760-pound projectile. And according to, obviously, what they think the German gun is going to be doing, the German gun translated over is firing about a 660-pound shell with approximately a 245-pound charge. So that means that the British gun is firing a slightly heavier projectile with slightly more power. Now, annoyingly, although penetration figures are supplied for both, they're not really directly comparable because it gives the 11.2-inch gun a penetration of wrought iron plate at the muzzle of 51.2 inches and 18 inches of penetration of steel plate at 5,000 yards, whereas for the Krupp gun, it gives a penetration of 914 millimetres of steel at the muzzle, which is about 36 inches, but which is, of course, a lot more than the 18 inches, but that's at 5,000 yards, not at the muzzle. And obviously 51.2 inches of wrought iron is more than 39 inches, but that's 39 inches of steel. But it also doesn't say, is this face-hardened steel? Is this standard-grade steel? So what exactly is going on there? And also, you know, how are you translating iron down to steel? As I've discussed before, when you go from iron armour to compound armour to steel armour to Harvey steel to Krupp steel, there are lots of different, this is equivalent to that figures floating around out there. So broadly speaking, it looks like the British gun is firing a heavier projectile with a greater charge. But unless we want to go into some really complicated mathematics, it's difficult to say who exactly is penetrating what more than the other. Now, as far as where this thing comes from, it shows up in every single listing of Coventry Ordnance Works guns from the minute they start publishing listings, which isn't very helpful because Coventry Ordnance Works is a relatively short-lived company that's actually set up not hugely before 1913 by various shipyards in an effort to compete with Vickers Armstrong. So it's a conglomerate of, you know, their various interests plus an Ordnance Works that Camel Laird had already bought up. And I suspect it's actually an 11-inch gun. I suspect the 11.2 is a typo because in various of the listings it's also listed as a 280mm gun, which is 11.02 inches, or near enough, as makes no difference, 11 inches, whereas the German 11.1-inch is a 283mm gun. Now, with all that said, I therefore suspect, although I can't necessarily prove with the level of digging I've done so far, that this is a holdover design from one of the companies that went in to form the Coventry Ordnance Works, possibly from the various bids for the very early España class designs, because some of the very earliest of the España class designs did in fact have 11-inch guns, although obviously they later settled on 12, or possibly one of the many other export design battleships that were being cooked up in the mid to late 1900s. Because by 1913, I mean, at that point, British Ordnance has been the 12-inch gun for a very long time, more lately the 13.5, and they're moving on to the 15. So, yeah, they're not designing this for a British market. Now, it would be interesting to do an even deeper dive into exactly where they came up with this design from. I'll have to try and hunt down where on earth the Coventry Ordnance Works archives have ended up. But for the minute, I would say that provisionally, it's probably a designed gun as opposed to something that was mass manufactured, that was probably done by one of Coventry Ordnance Works' predecessors in an effort to win a obviously unsuccessful bid for warship construction in the latter part of the 1900s, and they've just kept it on their book just in case somebody wanted it. Captain Charlemagne asks, in terms of ironclads, both USS New Ironsides and the French Gloire have a lot in common, such as being wooden-hulled ironclads. But, in your opinion, which was superior? Now, this does require a few caveats. Firstly, of course, Gloire is designed to be an ocean-going battleship, essentially. New Ironsides is designed to operate in much shallower coastal waters, so there's going to be some design element differences because of that. Another factor to bear in mind is that Gloire has about 1,500 tons on New Ironsides, so given that we're talking about ships that displace between 4,000 and 5,500 tons, that's actually quite a bit of difference. And their conception and construction is about 4 years apart. Now, if this was almost any other time in naval history, that wouldn't make too much odds, but in the early ironclad period, that's actually quite a long time. So, with those caveats in mind, let's have a bit of a closer look. Gloire is by far the faster of the two. New Ironsides is 7-8 knots on a good day. Gloire is 13 to 14 knots on a good day, so almost double. Now, of course, you do have to bear in mind that that is trial speeds for both. More realistically, you're looking at around about 5 to 6 knots for New Ironsides and 11 to 12 knots for Gloire, but weirdly enough, that actually maintains the fact that Gloire is roughly twice as fast as New Ironsides. Now, granted, Gloire does have 40% more power, but obviously she is also a bigger and heavier ship. So for her, with a 40% power advantage, but with that extra weight to go twice as fast, that definitely indicates that Gloire's hull form is a far superior hydrodynamic structure, which, again, isn't surprising because Gloire, as I said, was designed for ocean cruising. New Ironsides being designed specifically to be shallow draft is going to make some sacrifices in that regard. Protection-wise, maximum belt thickness is very close, and given the various issues with both American and French iron production and thickness and so forth at the time, I don't think the 0.2-inch difference really makes all that much odds. So in terms of main belt protection, you might as well probably call it a wash. Firepower, though, is a very interesting one. The Gloire is carrying far more guns, 3 dozen or so, but they are kind of the standard late 1850s French 6.5-inch rifled muzzle loader, as opposed to New Ironsides, which, although it carries significantly fewer guns, is carrying some rather larger guns, obviously its main battery being the 11-inch Dahlgrens. Although in a long-range fight, I suspect both sides would have significant issues trying to penetrate the other's armour, for all sorts of reasons which I've discussed in various other questions and when comparing things like Monitor and Warrior, for instance. Of course, as I said, Gloire being ocean-going, she draws almost twice as much water as New Ironsides. So I think in terms of which is better, I think you could split this into maybe at least four categories where you're going to have one ship being better than the other in those different categories. If you want to fight in a shallow water littoral environment, like, say, the east coast of the United States, New Ironsides is by far the superior ship simply because it's going to be able to access an awful lot more of those areas with its relatively shallow draft. Gloire, meanwhile, would be confined to much more restricted waters and, of course, would run the risk of going aground. The flip side to that, of course, is that if you want to go and exert your force of arms elsewhere other than your own coast, Gloire is by far the superior vessel. It's going to ride out storms a lot better, it's faster, it's going to be far more seaworthy, and, of course, if both ships are sailing for an arbitrary third-party destination and there's hostilities going on, if Gloire doesn't want to fight New Ironsides, she doesn't have to. She can very easily just ignore her. But if Gloire decides she is going to fight New Ironsides, there is basically nothing in the open sea that New Ironsides can do to stop Gloire closing in. And that then leads to straight up combat. Now, if you were going to fight the vast majority of warships in the early 1860s, that is wooden-hulled ships, I would actually personally take Gloire, because she's going to be firing considerably more shots per minute because she has a larger battery, and the guns being slightly smaller, it's going to make them slightly easier to reload. So when you just want to pump loads and loads of high explosive shell into wooden-hulled warships to set them on fire, Gloire is your ship to go for. Conversely, if you want to fight another fairly chunky ironclad, then New Ironsides probably has a slight advantage, not so much in the early stages of her career, but certainly by the end of the American Civil War, although obviously she doesn't survive that by all that much. But towards the end of her career, let's say 1865, when Dahlgren has issued new and updated guidance on just exactly how much powder and shot you can fit into a Dahlgren, then in a straight-up fight between the two, if they're just sitting broadside to broadside, I fractionally put my money on the New Ironsides, because there will be circumstances where those up-powered Dahlgrens might stand a chance of bashing in Gloire's armour, whereas, barring some major manufacturing faults in the American's armour, Gloire's 6.5-inch original guns will probably struggle. The flip side to that, of course, is if we hypothesised that New Ironsides survives into the latter part of the 1860s and Gloire gets her armament refit, then the advantage in terms of overall penetration almost certainly goes back to Gloire. Now, the one thing that could flip that balance in terms of Gloire versus New Ironsides straight-up fight, or Gloire versus similar ironclad straight-up fight, is that significant speed advantage that Gloire has. Because that speed advantage, in theory, would potentially allow Gloire to pull around the front or the bow or the stern of New Ironsides and rake her, a position which is not good even if you do happen to have armour. Because, well, obviously, potentially more damaging to you, but also you can't bring most of your battery to bear against your opponent. And while New Ironsides obviously can try and turn to present her own broadside, Gloire is just going to have a manoeuvrability advantage in open ocean waters. So adding all that up, I would say that on balance as a ship in the global naval environment at the time, Gloire is probably the superior of the two ironclads, whereas New Ironsides is the superior, as I said, littoral warship. But then again, does that come as a huge surprise? Gloire is a much larger ocean-going warship, as we said at the beginning. New Ironsides is a very specifically designed, essentially, if you like, forerunner of the coast defence battleship. So it's not surprising that they would excel in their particular fields, but of course Gloire being able to take itself and fight effectively in almost all parts of the ocean, whereas New Ironsides is rather heavily restricted, I think means that as a tool of general power projection, Gloire is the better vessel. Liv Tattell asks, did the US Navy convert any other warships to anti-aircraft gunnery training vessels in addition to the Wyoming? Yes, indeed they did, both before and after Wyoming. In fact, look at this glorious picture. I love glass plate pictures from the early 20th century. They can be digitized in such ridiculous resolution. Anyway, this is USS Utah in the late 1930s. She's Wyoming's immediate predecessor as an anti-aircraft gunnery training ship, and you might recognize some 5-inch 38s among a lot of other weapons on there. Of course, Utah was then sunk at Pearl Harbor, which was one of the driving factors in Wyoming getting such a heavy overhaul towards being an anti-aircraft training vessel. And once she was relieved of duty, the USS Mississippi was then used as an anti-aircraft training ship, among other things, but primarily anti-aircraft gunnery training as well. So, yeah, just within the US Navy, just the big headliners, there was a whole series of battleships turned into anti-aircraft drill ships, along with a handful of smaller ships that were also used for the purpose. PDKX4QW asks, had the 3-inch autoloaders, like the ones found on USS Salem, been available en masse earlier, Would they have made any difference in the anti-aircraft capability of US ships in the second half of the Pacific War? With the caveat that if we say if they'd been available with their auto-loading and radar guidance fire control systems, as per, as you can see here, this is one of the twin 3-inch autoloaders found on Salem, yes, they actually would have made quite a substantial difference for precisely the reason they were being introduced. Obviously, they were being introduced primarily to replace Bofors installations, and this was on a multi-part basis. Firstly, the 3-inch was about the smallest round they thought they could fit a VT fuse on. Obviously, the Bofors 40mm rounds, they couldn't. Secondly, the 3-inch obviously had a longer range than the 40mm Bofors, a longer effective range, and that meant you could hit a target further out, which meant you had a longer engagement time, and if the enemy was going to drop a bomb or a torpedo on you, then it kind of reset the ever-increasing brackets of range of my anti-aircraft gun versus range of your ability to drop your weapon, in favour of the defensive ship, obviously. And thirdly, particularly in relation to the late part of the Pacific War with kamikazes, if you scored a direct or near-direct hit with a 3-inch shell, there was a pretty good chance that you would either physically disintegrate the incoming attacker, or at least blow a big enough chunk of it off that it's going to go spiraling down into the sea. One of the problems with kamikazes specifically was that you could stitch them up quite a bit with 20mm and 40mm shells, and there was a chance, not necessarily a 100% chance, but still a reasonable chance, they might still keep coming. You know, you might have blown chunks off them, you might have set them on fire, and yes, you, congratulations, you have killed the plane, but that plane was intending to die anyway, so as long as they have some semblance of control, it just means they're already on fire by the time they hit you. Now, of course, that's not the case all the time. You know, you could, and obviously people did, blow significant chunks of an aircraft off with 40mm fire and they went into the drink or hit the fuel tank or the bomb or whatever and the thing exploded, or they just sawed it apart with enough hits, which is one of the reasons the British really liked the pom-pom against kamikazes. But ultimately, there was a chance that you might well score multiple 40mm hits on an incoming kamikaze and it would still hit you. With a 3-inch, as I said, it's a very, very small chance that something that's taken a good solid hit from a 3-inch round is still coming in the direction it was intending to. And of course, compared to a 5-inch 38, as good as those were, the 3-inch could fire a heck of a lot faster with auto-loading. So, yeah, if 3-inch autoloaders in the manner that they are found on USS Salem were widely available in the US Navy, let's say late 43, and they started putting them in instead of, let's say, quad Bofors mounts, I suspect there would have been considerably fewer kamikazes hitting various ships. The flip side, of course, to that is that outside of a few carriers, in terms of major warships, cruisers and battleships and so forth, the kamikazes didn't manage to inflict huge amounts of particularly critical damage. It was mostly the lighter warships, destroyers and auxiliaries and transports that took the brunt of those strikes. And of course, what characterises most of those ships is they actually don't have that many anti-aircraft installations in the first place. But, of course, there is the other thing, which is having a longer range. Whereas if you're in a destroyer, let's say, under kamikaze attack, and there's another destroyer a mile away, and they can't really cover you all that well with their 40mm batteries. But if they have a couple of twin 3-inch instead of a bunch of 40mm batteries, they might well be able to cover you. And if they can, then probably the destroyer on your other side can as well. And suddenly you've got at least three sets of 3-inch auto-loading batteries directed at a specific kamikaze. And that may very well save your bacon, even though you don't necessarily have quite as many as you might find on a big ship. Generic Person X asks, what was the official stated reason for retaining USS Wyoming under the Washington Naval Treaty, considering she was a rather obsolescent battleship by 1920 standards with her coal firing and 12-inch guns? A combination of two things. Firstly, the US didn't have enough modern, if you like, super dreadnought style battleships to just have those in their fleet. And secondly, she was still competitive with a large majority of other ships, which everybody else was having to keep. So if you look at the list of ships which may be retained in the Washington Naval Treaty, for the US, it starts off obviously with the Tennessees and Maryland, which is the first of the Colorados to complete. And the US is obviously going to get two more Colorados. And in exchange, once the two Colorados are built, they have to scrap North Dakota and Delaware. But at the time of the treaty, until the completion of those ships, they have the Delawares. They also have the Floridas. So basically, they have everything that they've built, at least in dreadnought terms, with the exception of the South Carolinas, which the US wasn't even rating as dreadnoughts by partway through the First World War. And even then, their total tonnage is only just scraping over the 500,000 ton limit. Bear in mind, they have a 525,000 ton limit. And once they've swapped out North Dakota and Delaware for the remaining two Colorados, then they are at their limit. So you've got to keep Wyoming around because, you know, along with Arkansas, they're actually the most modern and most capable of your 12-inch ships. You're also going to be hauling Utah and Florida around for a while. And then you look at the British section, and they don't have any of their 12-inch ships. In fact, they don't even have the Orions, their first generation of super dreadnoughts. They've got their second class of super dreadnoughts, the World War I King George V's, then the Iron Dukes, the Queen Elizabeths, the Revenges, Hood, Renown, Repulse, and Tiger. And they're going to ditch the King George V's for the Nelsons. And even then, they're going to have slightly more tonnage than the US fleet does. So against the Royal Navy, you need to keep Wyoming around, if nothing else, just to make up the numbers. But then when you look at Italy, France, and Japan, well, starting off with Japan, thanks to their much reduced tonnage limit and the fact the Japanese don't particularly want them, they are getting rid of the Koachis. So all the Japanese combatants have 14 or 16-inch guns, which you might think, okay, well, Wyoming's at a disadvantage there. Yes, however, remember, four of those combatants are the Congos, and, well, Wyoming's 12-inch guns can still hurt Congos. And then you look at the French, and yes, the French have got the Britannias, which are theoretically a generation beyond the Wyoming, but they've also got the Courbets, which are comparative generation-wise, and you could argue perhaps in some respects the Wyomings are, or Wyoming is better. And they have three of their Danton-class semi-dreadnoughts, and Wyoming's definitely better than them. And it's a similar story with the Italians. You can make arguments back and forth as to who stacks up better between Wyoming and the Dorias and Dante Alighieri and the Conte di Cavours, but you've also got four of the Italian pre-dreadnoughts there. And again, Wyoming's definitely better than them, potentially either better or at least on a par with most of the rest of the Italian fleet. So against anyone who isn't the Royal Navy, in terms of treaty signees, Wyoming has either some or very clear advantages over a decent chunk of all those other ships. And against the Royal Navy, as we said, well, you need every ship you can get, and this is pretty much every ship the US can get. BK Zhong asks, which action the Enterprise was involved in do you see as her greatest achievement? So many choices. I would think, actually, for me, in terms of the broader context, I think I would actually pick Battle of Santa Cruz Islands and its immediate aftermath, because you go very quickly in the Guadalcanal campaign from having Saratoga, Wasp, Enterprise, and Hornet on the way to, well, Wasp is gone, so it's Saratoga and Enterprise, then it's just Enterprise, then it's Enterprise and Hornet, and then it's just Enterprise, and for a good long chunk of time during the pretty much the peak of the Guadalcanal campaign, this battered, scarred carrier is the sole representative of US Navy carrier power in the Western Pacific. And that's quite important, because starting with Santa Cruz, obviously Santa Cruz Islands doesn't go particularly well for the US in terms of carrier losses, because Hornet goes down. But Enterprise's flyers are vital in that, because while both of the Shikakus do survive, it's not intact, and their air group's definitely not. So she holds the line there, and remains afloat. And that's quite critical, because obviously with the Hiryu, Soryu, Akagi and Kaga gone at Midway, and then the two remaining big Japanese fleet carriers, the Shikakus, having to withdraw as a result of Santa Cruz Islands, although Enterprise is this battered, limping veteran who's just one ship, she is also the only full-fledged fleet carrier that either side can send into the area. Yeah, you can send Hio or Junyo in if you really, really wanted to, if one of them's not damaged, but, well, just ask John Barshall what he thinks of the Hios. Yeah, they're not terrible for what they are, but they are not particularly brilliant fleet carriers. They're kind of in this weird, awkward middle phase between they're bigger and more capable than a light carrier, but not quite as capable as a fleet carrier. And in a one-on-one, Enterprise will beat them. And that means she's able to continue to provide aircraft ferrying and air support and air strikes during that critical phase of the Guadalcanal campaign. Hence why you have the whole Enterprise versus Japan thing that the crew have going. And it's only once Saratoga makes it back after repairs that she's able to go home, but she has held the line. And she's held the line during pretty much the most desperate portion of the Pacific campaign for the US. Because obviously then you have Saratoga and Victoria's holding the line against a potential resurgent Japanese threat. But as it turns out, the carrier threat doesn't materialize. The bulk of the Guadalcanal campaign is over. Its fighting is not done, but it's definitely moving in the US's favor. And by the time the Japanese do show up again in force, well, the Essex Swarm has arrived, so everything's looking sunshine and roses to a degree for the US Navy. Warrant Officer Will asks, in Dry Dock 357, in response to my question about the Allied use of autogyros, you said they wouldn't have been suited to serve due to technological limitations. But then, what was Japan doing? The Japanese did use autogyros as anti-submarine platforms, so what made it different to the Allied situation? In short, absolute desperation. Because the Japanese autogyros, you can see one of them here, were never supposed to be anti-submarine aircraft. They were developed by the Japanese army as artillery spotters. And to be fair, given their extreme rough field capabilities and the situation the Japanese army was mostly using them in over in China, it wasn't a bad shout. I mean, there are other options, but in that kind of environment, an autogyro is not a terrible idea for artillery spotting. However, as the situation rapidly began to get worse in the ocean area, the Japanese army was obviously worried about their troop transports and supply transports being attacked by submarines, and American carrier aircraft for that matter, but mostly submarines. And they had two possible solutions. One of which was to ask the Japanese Navy for more help, and the other was to try and do it themselves. And, well, if you ask the Japanese Navy to help the Japanese Army, particularly, of course, because the Japanese Army has built their own little mini aircraft carriers, including things like the Akitsu Maru, which is half aircraft carrier, half assault ship, some particularly well-read Japanese naval officer is going to turn around and say, there is no curse in Entish, Elvish, or the tongues of men strong enough to express my utter hatred for the Imperial Japanese Army. No, they will not be getting any more help than we deign to give them. And they're definitely not getting aircraft to operate off of their cheaty little carriers. and the Japanese Army kind of knew that. So they just went, well, we need something that's good at spotting that we can base off of a sort of carrier with a very short runway. And that, you know, we actually have, because we don't have the time or the money to start building a whole new production run of, you know, short takeoff anti-submarine aircraft, which is not something an army should be building. So they went, these autogyros will work, I guess. And, well, that lasted for as long as Akitsu Maru did. And then, like, well, we've still got some of them, so I guess we put them on shore and use them that way. So, you know, yes, it's kind of reprising my answer to the previous question. Yes, you can use autogyros to do anti-submarine warfare. They won't be as good as dedicated aircraft, especially because dedicated aircraft can carry depth charges and so forth. But they're better than nothing. And for the Imperial Japanese Army, nothing was the alternative. Whereas for the Allies, they had all sorts of weird and wonderful aircraft that could do a better job than an autogyro. Josh Thomas Moore asks, on the back of the Fletcher's main turrets, there's a part that juts out at the back. What is that for? Well, here you can see the thing on the back of, this is actually Fletcher itself, and there is this kind of weird off-angle bit that's sticking out the back. This is actually the part of the case ejection system, because of course this is a relatively small enclosed gun mount, and it's one that can fire pretty darn quickly. And of course the 5-inch 38 gun uses a brass case for its charge, and when that case comes out of the gun, it is very, very hot. You do not want a very hot brass case bouncing around inside a relatively enclosed mounting that's got a lot of people inside it. Far less do you want several dozen of them building up. So you get rid of them pretty darn quickly. The only problem, of course, is that especially on a destroyer, you might have all sorts of weather-related issues, and also, particularly paying attention to fighting in darkness and such, like if you just have a simple hatch, then every time you open it up, obviously the interior of the mount is going to be lit up, so you might be, you know, flashing lights at potential enemy targets. So both for weatherproofing and for battleproofing, the case ejector has this little pathway which then allows it to dump the cartridge case out onto the deck. So when you look at some photos of Fletcher classes in profile, you'll see this coming out the back, and now you know what it is. And yes, there were equivalents in the twin mounts and so forth, obviously not in the shielded only and open mounts. Patalong15 asks, which European Navy do you find most difficult to research into in terms of access to archival materials and primary sources, and why? Honestly, it varies. There are swings and roundabouts to each of the archives, at least for what you might term the archives of the major navies for the time period the channel covers. For example, the Italian archives are generally quite friendly, a little bit scattered, and there is a bunch of material that's just, you know, missing because it's still in the hands of various individuals and their families, especially for the 20th century. The other thing with the Italian archives is that it's not that difficult to get hold of in terms of if you send them enough emails or give them enough phone calls, they will respond. It's more just a fact of finding those contact details in the first place. It can be a little bit difficult because, as I said, everything's a bit scattered. The German archives, the Bundesarchiv, I think that's how it's pronounced, just ask military aviation history or military history visualized, because obviously they do all this stuff in the native languages, which is obviously much easier than for me. But the Bundesarchiv is one of these slightly odd ones in that if you can get access, they have some of the best organized archives. You know, everything is mostly in a few central locations. Unsurprisingly, for an archive, it is very well organized. I will put that caveat in because I don't think thus far I've come across any archive that is what you might describe as massively well organized. But then that's the nature of archives, because they're not, you know, they're not taking a body of documentation and going, okay, we're going to sort this out in a nice logical process. It's, well, this decade we've got these documents, and this decade we've got these documents, and these documents might relate to these earlier ones, or they might not. They might be brand new, and, well, we're going to have to somehow fit them into the pre-existing archival system. Or maybe we'll overhaul it, but then reset the problem 10 years down the line. They're reasonably well organized, but of all the archives I've dealt with, they have the most restrictive processes when it comes to using the information. You know, now, if you really want to get a full understanding of that, again, watch Chris's channel. That's Military Aviation History. And you know, there are times when he's literally been there going, look, I have the documents and the pictures in front of me from the Bundesarchiv. I can't show you them because of the terms and conditions of how I got hold of them, but I can look at them here on my laptop screen and I can tell you about them. That's a level of restriction which I've basically not encountered anywhere else, at least in my archival journey. So it's, you know, you can get hold of the information, but then how you present that information is actually somewhat more difficult. The French archives, a little bit like the Italian archives, a bit scattered all over the place, and can, again, be difficult to get hold of the right people. But if you know how to deal with them, you can find some very interesting stuff. And the other weird thing is, because of the way everything is scattered around, you might go looking for something. You might not find it, but you might find something completely irrelevant to what you were originally looking for, which is actually also really interesting. The Spanish archives, again, not had a huge amount of dealings with them, but they've been somewhat easier to deal with in some ways because they don't have quite the same level of scatter problems that some other European archives, including, to be honest, the British ones do. Their archives are much more concentrated in a few areas, one of which moved recently. And I do have a slight advantage, of course, in that my mother is Bolivian, and therefore, obviously, she speaks Spanish fluently. I have a working knowledge of Spanish, which tends to come back the more I'm immersed in Spanish-speaking environments. But that aside, I can draft a half-decent Spanish email. I can obviously get my mum to check it. And as you might expect, correspondence goes better in one's native language. But obviously, that's correspondence with the Spanish, who speak Spanish. And then when I get the correspondence back, I can usually make out vaguely what they're on about, run it through some translate just to make sure that I was correct. And happy days. Of course, the limitation with the Spanish archives is that most of what I'd be interested in the Spanish archives tends to be the slightly older Age of Sail stuff, which in and of itself, for obvious reasons, is a bit more delicate, a bit harder to get hold of, a little bit more scattered, and of course is going to be entirely handwritten. And while I have a reasonable command of reading Spanish, there's a difference between being able to read Spanish as it exists nowadays and being able to read some 17th or 18th century officer's handwritten scrawl, which, yeah, that's fun. It's difficult enough reading 17th, 18th century English officer's scrawl, let alone the Spanish. Blocchio asks, if turbine engines, for whatever reason, had not proven to be a viable technology for ship propulsion, where do you think developments would have led? Would this have resulted in long-range gunnery never becoming a thing because of engine vibrations? Or was there another technology that might have remedied the problem? Well, I think there would have been a number of different ways of going about alternate engine implementations, as well as perhaps the adoption of some later technologies as well. So, historically speaking, for the most part, ships abandon, or at least warships abandon, the vertical triple expansion engine in favour of the turbine over the course of the 1900s to the early 1910s. However, the vertical triple expansion engine doesn't die just because major warships aren't using it anymore. Because, of course, merchant ships, ocean liners and stuff, while they are in some cases using turbines, an awful lot of them will continue to use the vertical triple expansion engine. And they're obviously always in the search for more efficiency and various other problems that need solving. And some navies, like the US Navy, persist in using the vertical triple expansion engine for a while as well. So what you would probably see is, well, the historical developments of forced lubrication and the quadruple expansion engine probably both coming into play in a major way in large capital ships. This might also initially make either dreadnoughts less efficient or maybe not even possible, depending on exactly how you want to define them. Because remember, of course, one of the reasons that the Germans ended up with the hexagonal layout with the Nassaus was because they stuck with vertical triple expansion engines, and they therefore, you know, because they take up more space than turbines, they took up so much space, they had to have this rather inefficient hexagonal layout where they had 12 guns on the ship but an 8-gun broadside, as opposed to Dreadnought having 10 guns on the ship for an 8-gun broadside. Now, of course, you do have the South Carolinas, which have vertical triple expansion engines and 8 guns for an 8-gun broadside, but they also adopt true super firing. So you could see either people go kind of the German route of having far more guns than they can ever bring to bear on the broadside, or it might force a more rapid acceleration into the realms of true superfiring gun mounts. Now, obviously, as forced lubrication quadruple expansion engines and even forced lubrication vertical triple expansion engines come into play, then they'd also probably start looking at addressing things like the vibration issues where possible. But of course, you also have in the First World War the start of diesel technology on ships, the Germans particularly going in for this. And I think in the aftermath, certainly, of the First World War, with a lot of attention being paid to German diesel engines, I think you might actually see diesels having a lot more development put into them, so therefore their power density increasing somewhat faster than it did historically. And there might also have been much more of a push for turbo electric or diesel electric drive, because if turbines aren't directly viable for ship propulsion, that technically doesn't rule out using them for a turbo electric drive. And obviously it's a little bit bigger and heavier than a turbine or geared turbine drive, but you know, that there's the whole, you know, turbo electric versus geared turbines debate to have. But if you don't have geared turbines, well, turbo electric actually starts looking pretty neat as a solution. Vokir asks, how much did the invasion scares of the latter half of the 1800s influence the ship design and procurement in the Royal Navy in the Victorian period? There was some influence, but not hugely directly for the most part. Usually what would happen is that if an invasion scare got really panicky up in public society, the Royal Navy would try and leverage that towards just more funding. So essentially they would say, yeah, okay, if you're that worried about the French or the Germans or you know, whoever this particular invasion scare is about, if you're worried about them coming over and invading the South Coast for whatever reason, then clearly, as your little Penny Dreadful says, we need more ships, so give us more money and we'll give you more ships. No, you don't get to design them, points HMS Captain. Overall, apart from some initial criticism in the press when someone was like, the Navy doesn't have enough ships, it doesn't have enough of the right kind of ships, blah, 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 usually the Royal Navy made out a little bit like a pirate when it came to that kind of thing. Occasionally, public pressure would force them into designing somewhat more specific ships, whereas obviously the Royal Navy would generally prefer to have big ocean-going ships that could do a little bit of everything. Sometimes either public pressure or limited amounts of funds that were released due to public pressure would mean that it would be seen as perhaps better to try experimenting with building coastal defence ships. That didn't usually work out. As it turns out, the French were much better at building coastal defence ships than the Royal Navy generally was. The only times the Royal Navy kind of lost out would be when people got really scared about some new technological development and concluded that it would be faster to fortify the country than it would be to rebuild the entire fleet. And so you end up with a whole slew of forts, both on the coast and further inland, being built during the last part of the 19th century, which honestly, obviously, the Navy would have preferred to have that funding. The Army and particularly the artillery were quite happy to have some new toys to play with. But a lot of those fortifications ended up having even shorter service lives than ships that were being built around the same time. I mean, 10-15 minutes down the road from me, there's a fort overlooking the South Downs, or the edge of the Thames Valley Basin, which was built in response to invasion scares in the last part of the 19th century and was pretty much defunct within a couple of decades, very briefly brought back again in the run-up to World War I and then went defunct again, although it makes an interesting walk nowadays. Alex Cheng asks, during the early age of sail in East Asia, large iron-tipped wooden arrows were sometimes shot out of cannon, especially by the Japanese with a bohia and the Koreans with the chongtong and jangunjeong, possibly. While these seem to have been shot out of lighter guns compared to what European navies were fielding by the 17th century and beyond, how would a scaled-up version have performed during the latter half of the age of sail? Would the mass of the projectile and the fin stabilization given it improve range and penetration over other types of ammunition?
arrow firing cannons in Europe actually appear to have been some of the very first ever used, as you can see from this illustration, also known as a vase de feu. You can see it's this sort of vase-shaped brass cannon firing a little arrow out the front. Now, if you were to fast forward that to the 12, 18, 24, 32 pounder, etc. cannon of the latter part of the Age of Sail, you'd face one of two problems. Either you have some kind of like sabot-style ammunition or sabot ammunition, where you'd have a reasonably chunky arrow, but something that could fit entirely within the cannon, with maybe some a discarding wooden saber or something. Now, in theory, that would give you something that would go very fast and relatively far, and with relatively decent accuracy. But it would be complicated by the fact you're still on a moving ship. So, as the ship rolls, if the gun's pointing down, you will very, very accurately hit the sea. And it's not going to skip across the sea, which cannonballs could do. But while you might get better range, the fact that it has less mass and it is a sharpened projectile going up against what ultimately is going to be anything up to, several feet of wood, means that its penetration is probably not going to be that great. It might have some utility against sails, I suppose, as a long-range dismasting shot, but very, very limited. And of course, it'd be a lot harder to load, because unlike a cannonball, which you can just chuck down and it rolls, with this thing, you would have to make sure you load it very specifically the right way around. The other alternative would be to do something like what the Japanese and the Koreans did, and that would be to match the arrow to the cannon in terms of shaft size, and then you have to put the fins kind of part way along, because then obviously they won't fit inside the cannon bore. And that would give you a considerably heavier piece of ammunition, because of course it's occupying a good chunk of the length of the barrel plus a bit outside. And even if you make that out of wood, and you don't want to, because you're just going to end up creating a splinter shotgun, but make a chunk of it out of wood and a bunch of it out of iron, big iron head, some iron reinforcement at the bottom, some strapping, so on and so forth. Yeah, you'd end up with something a lot heavier and potentially being essentially a long rod penetrator, potentially having better penetration than the average cannonball. But you've got to remember that, firstly, the average cannonball at close range could blow straight through one side of a ship and out the other anyway. So penetration wasn't really a problem. You might get longer range because of its shape, but equally, the extra weight, could cause problems with additional pressure building up in the gun. That could make the gun explode, or it might mean that there's too much friction and too much weight to fully develop the power of the powder. So it might not go as far. All of that would obviously have to be done under quite a bit of testing. And ultimately, it would be a very expensive piece of ammunition, much more difficult to load. And a good chunk of the damage caused by gunfire in the Age of Sail was by splintering, and something that's a very pointy long projectile that's punching a nice neat hole through is less likely to cause the massive splinters that the shock wave of a big round lump of metal arriving would do. So overall, probably not the best idea. Potentially, if you were using it in short barrel cannon howitzers and mortars, potentially might have some usefulness, especially if you combine it with incendiaries, as a coastal defense weapon where you don't have to worry about your guns rolling and pitching every 5 seconds. But as a ship mounted weapon, I wouldn't put my money on it. 31 Knot Burke, Chief of Naval Operations, asks, I've seen a number of claims that during the Battle of Cape Esperance, the cruiser Alba flashed its identification signal at the American task force, thinking they were friendly. However, these claims are fairly conflicting in their details, especially on whether or not the signal was sent before or after the Americans opened fire. Could you shed any light on what actually happened? So, fortunately, one of the books that I managed to bring back from my trip to Japan is a Japanese language and book that hasn't been translated into English, which details, among other things, the Guadalcanal campaign. And I cross-checked that with the relevant volume of Senshi Shoho, and According to the Japanese language sources, which obviously theoretically should have a better idea of what was going on in the Japanese fleet, it appears that what happened was that, as is commonly known, that the Japanese force thought that perhaps this force that they'd sighted was a friendly force, because they knew there was another friendly force out there somewhere. And what seems to have happened is that Alba started to signal that she was friendly, but this was not quite coincidental with the American forces opening fire, but right before it. So, a matter of seconds or tens of seconds beforehand. And then obviously the American fleet opens fire, which badly injures the fatally injures the admiral, the Japanese admiral, who is reported to have said some not particularly polite things at the time, not just because he'd just been mortally wounded, but because he thought he was being fired on by his own ships. And then Alba, as she hauls out of line, continues to, under the mistaken impression that she's being fired on in a friendly fire incident, continues to signal, "I am Alba," which obviously at that point is signaling after the Americans have opened fire. So as far as I can tell, that seems to be the most likely turn of events. Richard Chu asks, in the alt history world of Kaiserreich, the lore behind the American non-intervention in World War One includes an accidental sinking by a British submarine of an American merchant ship carrying Christmas gifts bound for Germany. My question is, were British submarines in World War One deployed and acting in a manner that would have made such an accidental sinking of an American merchant ship possible? Short answer, no, it's not actually plausible at all. Now, I don't know a huge amount about the Kaiserreich setting. I'm informed by some people who do know a bit more about the setting that apparently there was a slightly more complex plan for that whole incident that didn't go through in the final law. But for whatever reason, the final law is an American merchant ship carrying Christmas gifts is sunk by a British submarine. And frankly, it's a bit ridiculous because when you look at where the British submarines were deployed, outside of some deployments to the Mediterranean and obviously for the Gallipoli campaign, the vast majority, if not almost all other remaining British subs, are deployed in the Channel, in the North Sea, and in the Baltic, because, well, that's where the enemy is. There is no reason for the British to deploy submarines into the Atlantic, because there's precious few, if any, German ships out there. And certainly after the first few months of the war, that number of German ships out there has dropped even more steeply. And what there is out there can be dealt with by armed merchant cruisers and general surface warships. Unless, of course, they're U-boats. But even in dealing with U-boats, while British submarines were actually on anti-U-boat operations and did sink quite a few, again, it was within the confines of the Channel and the North Sea, within the realms of the British distant blockade. Now, American merchant ships did try to trade with Germany, but they were intercepted at sea by the forces of the British distant blockade, inspected, and almost invariably told, thanks but no thanks, back you go, or off to a neutral port you go. There were very, very few instances of American merchant ships, by hook or by crook, making it past the blockade and into the contested waters of the North Sea. And those few dried up pretty quickly as time went on. Now, there were a few American crewed ships under different flags operating in the area, but that's a little bit different from an American flagged ship with an American crew going specifically from America to Germany. And quite aside from that, even in the extremely implausibly unlikely event that somebody in America was mad enough to fill a cargo ship full of random Christmas gifts and find a crew who were mad enough to actually try and sneak past the British blockade and were skilled enough to sneak past the British blockade, which in 1917 was quite a tight operation, and then somehow, stacking magic wonder on magic wonder, made it into the North Sea, where there's a remote chance they might actually encounter a British submarine. Well, the the British submarines aren't really in the business of going after much in the way of trade because, well, there isn't much in the way of trade out there. And again, what trade there is in the North Sea is by far the majority either friendly or neutral. So randomly blowing up merchant ships is a really, really bad idea. So they're mostly gunning for either occasionally coastal trade off enemy-held coastlines, which obviously they know is an enemy ship, or they're going after warships, or they're doing other things like hunting U-boats, scouting coasts and minefields and so forth. They're not doing the U-boat thing of, you know, sneak up and blow up enemy merchant ships. And if this American merchant ship was actually flying an American flag, well, they'd see it and they'd go, well, that seems odd, but whatever. At worst, you get the sub probably doing a cruiser warfare rules thing of popping up and going, oi, pull over, mate. We want to inspect you and find out, one, why the heck are you here? Two, how the heck are you here? And three, is there anything on board that we need to know about? They're not just going to arbitrarily torpedo it apropos of nothing. So yeah, unfortunately, as written, that particular incident is incredibly implausible. Texas and La Shock asks, where is your popcorn threshold when it comes to movies? If we put Master and Commander at one end of the scale for accuracy and attention to detail, further down Midway, which is ostensibly trying to be accurate but has a number of glaring errors, and then at the other end, Muppet Treasure Island, where there are constant references to 1990s pop culture and Tim Curry is acting like a Muppet, at what point do you just grab the popcorn and shut your brain off? So in terms of movies that are either naval movies or have significant naval content, I guess the best way of describing it would be I have a kind of an uncanny valley where it's not something that I would watch or that I would get very annoyed and angry if I watch. And so and that basically means, for those of you who are unaware of the term, without going into it in too much detail, is essentially there's stuff which I'll go, yep, I'm definitely watching this and I appreciate it. And there's stuff I'm watching it where I'm going, this is a popcorn movie, sit back and relax. But there's a point in between where you can get this horrible hybrid. And those are the movies I won't tend to watch. So, like I say, Master and Commander does an excellent job of portraying the Napoleonic era Age of Sail. And as such, you know, any small changes and so forth that were made for artistic license, easily forgivable. And, you know, I'm watching a movie which I can enjoy as a movie, as a piece of art, but also knowing as I watch it that, you know, there's a good chunk of what's going on here that is correct. At the other end of things, obviously, yeah, you've got things like Muppet Treasure Island, stuff where movies are very clearly completely off the radar as far as realism is concerned. So yeah, sit back and relax. I, although I know my good friend Ryan Szymanski feels somewhat differently, would actually put the movie Battleship, hence the screenshot, into this category as well. Because it's a sci-fi movie, essentially. So it's already not going to be realistic for obvious reasons. And therefore, while having, you know, quite a lot of naval elements in it, it's very obviously not trying to be realistic. It's not making any pretensions to being realistic, at which point I can just switch my brain off and go, yeah, I know that's completely ridiculous, but it's also really, really cool. And no one ever said it was going to try and be realistic. So I can enjoy it for what it is. Where the movies that I won't watch or won't watch again if I've had the misfortune to watch them the first time, perhaps except in edit highlights, would be movies where they have made some kind of pretension to be telling, you know, history as it was, or to being accurate, or the, you know, the infamous based on a true story. But once they have made that claim, so they've put their little stall out and said, hey, look, one of our main attractions is that we are historically accurate, or at least historically plausible. And then they turn around and do really dumb stuff that, to be honest, a lot of the time would actually be egregious, even by the standards of movies that aren't trying to be historically accurate. Those are the movies where I go, no, I'm not tolerating this. I don't want to watch this. And I think that's part and parcel of the fact that, at least for me personally, hypocrisy is one of my absolutely biggest grievances with anything and anyone that practices it. Generally speaking, I'll give far more leeway to someone or something that is straight up honest with what they're doing than I will with someone who is being incredibly hypocritical and two-faced about what they're doing, concealing something that they're doing that may be as bad as the other guy or the other movie, or may even be fractionally less bad, honestly. But if they're hiding it under some sort of cloak of pretending to do good or pretending to be historically accurate, I'm going to view that a lot more harshly because you're doing a bad job and you're being dishonest about it. Whereas, you know, at least if you're straight up about what you're doing, it might be horrific, but at least we all know where we stand, which is a start. Take, for example, actually one of my favourite examples for this kind of thing, the Kingsman movie, the sort of prequel set in World War One. It is an absolute popcorn movie. It is making no pretensions to being historically accurate. I mean, heck, you've got, you know, one of the trailers is Rasputin doing a sword-filled breakdance to the track of Rah Rah Rasputin, which is absolutely fantastic, by the way. Completely ahistorical, but hilarious. But as I pointed out, I think in a few other dry docks, despite the sort of the ridiculous, almost fantasy elements that are in that movie, where they touch on stuff that's, you know, in that actually either happened or happened and matters adjacent to it happened, like the trench fighting scene, or more accurately, the no man's land fighting scene, or the sinking of HMS Hampshire. The historical elements they weave into those are actually pretty darn good. At some point, I'll probably need to do a quick, you know, maybe 5-minute video on that HMS Hampshire sequence and showing which bits are actually really accurate and which bits obviously are not. My friend Matt Easton, Scholar of Gladiatoria, has done a breakdown of the No Man's Land melee fight and, you know, which bits are plausible and which bits are made up for the movie. And again, it's pretty darn good, believe it or not. And that's a movie that's making no pretensions to historical accuracy. And then you get something like Midway, which is making pretensions to historical accuracy and therefore has set a much higher bar for itself and then fails abysmally in so many of its visuals, without, you know, rehashing my many grievances with that movie. So, yeah. There are actually movies that are way less historically accurate, which I'll very happily sit down and watch with a massive bucket of popcorn. But and then other movies which might get a few things right here and there, but otherwise get a lot of things wrong, but I personally won't have anything to do with, simply because they've made a much higher bar for themselves and then spectacularly failed to clear it. Yakuza Girls Marines High School Training Vessel Harakaze asks, many, if not all of us here, know the escapades of the Polish submarine Orzel. I'm trying, Polish people. Both trying to fight, getting interned, and then escaping to dear old Blighty to keep going. Can you name a few ships or boats that have also done similar feats in terms of naval escapades? Also, when will you do a video on said Polish submarine, as you once mentioned? Well, there's a few different interesting ones. Of course, there's the Abram Krainchen, the Dutch ship that, you know, upon seeing the massive number of Japanese forces descending on its position, decided to go, no, I am an island. Clearly, you cannot bomb me because I hold no strategic value. I'm just a small clump of trees that happens to be suspiciously moving in the direction of safety, but never mind. And they manage it. And I need to revisit that ship at some point. While not in the face of enemy action, I'm also quite partial to the story of the USS R-14. That's one of the American World War One era subs, but shortly after World War One, she found herself stranded in the middle of the Pacific with dead engines, and the crew decided, we're going to make ourselves some sails. And not content with a kind of a Jack Sparrow-esque escapade, they not only rigged a sail, they rigged three sails, thus technically with three sails on three masts, making them a ship, and proceeded to sail their sub at admittedly fairly slow speed all the way back to Hawaii. Then there's, of course, Nelson, who sails his ship through an entire enemy fleet. And bear in mind, at that point, he's in a little frigate, so if he is discovered, he is very dead, but manages to pull that off in night and fog. And while they didn't end up being almost seized by random port authorities, the voyage of pretty much the entirety of the Belgian Navy in a single ship over to the UK under very similar circumstances to the Polish Navy is, you know, a story in and of itself. Now, as far as a video on the Orgel or Orzel, or I'm still trying to figure out how it's pronounced properly. Anyway, the Polish sub, that is scheduled for some point in the coming year. So hopefully you'll see it sooner rather than later. And that's it for this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. And I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.